Move to the fourth case this morning, McDowell v. Kingston.
May it please the court. Good morning, Judge Caney, Judge Wood, Chris Terrell on behalf of Darrell S. McDowell. As the court is aware, this matter comes today before you from a denial of a petition for writ of habeas corpus that was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Subsequent thereto, an order granting certificate of appealability was thereafter granted. The order was granted on the sole issue before this court. That issue is as follows. Whether the state court decisions rejecting petitioner's Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel claim were contrary to clearly established federal law within the meaning of 28 U.S.C. section 2254 subsection D. Now, since this matter comes before the court seeking habeas corpus relief, the dreaded, and I call it the dreaded, Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 applies. I don't know if I should call it the AEDPA or AEDPA. I'm going to simply call it by its letters. The AEDPA dictates that a federal court may only grant a writ of habeas corpus under the following circumstances: on a claim adjudicated on its merits in state court, only if the state court's decision was contrary to or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the United States Supreme Court.
Now, Mr. Chiarella, as you probably know, this is something with which this court is all too familiar. And I just wanted to clarify two things about the petition you're bringing before us today. First of all, that you are, in fact, and this is a question, not arguing actual prejudice anymore. We all know this is about Strickland. This is about ineffective assistance of counsel. And as I understand it, two issues are not on the table. Number one, the issue of defective performance. That seems to be conceded. That's right?
Correct. That was granted by all courts, conceded
right.
by the state, and we don't object.
Okay. No, he wouldn't. and number two, that we are not discussing whether there was actual prejudice anymore. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So we're only talking about whether either Kronick or Kyler gives rise to some kind of presumed prejudice rule.
That is a correct statement.
Okay.
And as I indicated, there are two circumstances. One of them is where, under AEDPA, whether or not the decision resulted in a decision that was based on an unreasonable determination of facts in light of the evidence presented in a state court proceeding. That's not before you either. The only issue before you is whether or not the state court decision was contrary to a clearly established federal law.
And it's the two Supreme Court cases I just mentioned, particularly Kronick, as I understand it.
That is correct.
Maybe a little bit of Nix against Whiteside, too. But so why does this fit Kronick? I mean, it's not like Mr. Langford, you know, took a long break, you know, and went and worked out in the gym while Mr. McDowell was giving his testimony in the narrative form. He was there, and he was maybe surprised him by failing to ask for a recess just to say we're going to switch over to narrative now as we've discussed, you know, or whatever. Why is this Kronick?
There are three circumstances that have been carved out by Kronick. One of the circumstances is where, and I want to make certain that I say this, is where defendants denied counsel at a critical stage of the proceeding. My position on behalf of McDowell, I've represented this gentleman for close to 6 years now. My position has always been that he was denied counsel at a critical stage of the proceeding. What was that critical stage? The critical stage of this case, and I've tried to make this as blunt as I possibly could in my briefs, was this was a sexual assault case where, in any sexual assault case, you've got two defenses. It's either consensual or it did not happen. That's how you defend these cases. A defendant in a sexual assault case has to come to terms with the possibility of, am I going to testify or am I not going to testify? In this case, on the second day of trial, at the conclusion of the state's case, counsel for the defense got up and told the court, my client is going to testify tomorrow. He's come to that conclusion. The court conducted a colloquy with the defendant and with counsel, and it was all agreed to at the close of the second day that he was going to testify. The next day, counsel appears and says, I'm going to withdraw, or I'd like to withdraw as counsel. He indicates to the court that it's because of some perceived problem with testimony being presented at the trial. Doesn't indicate who this is from, but that he believes that there's some perceived problem. A break is held. talks to his client, and I want to make certain that I get this wording correct because this is absolutely important to my argument. Counsel indicates to the court before presenting, before even giving his opening, which I'm sure we all know he deferred, he says, I've spoken to my client. He wants to testify. What he will testify to will be the absolute truth. And then he quotes, and then he stated, Judge, I have no reason to believe, in light of what Mr. McDowell has told me, that he will not get up there and testify to the truth. I will be asking him questions, specific questions, with respect to his testimony before this jury. At that juncture, counsel for the defense, lead counsel, told the court, A, my client's going to testify, B, he's going to testify truthfully, and C, I'm going to ask him questions, and he's going to give me answers. You're the defendant in a criminal case on trial for your life, basically. I mean, he got 200 years in this case. He's sitting there thinking, okay, my attorney's going to counsel me, and he's going to guide me through. Important to note, counsel testified also at the post-conviction Mockner hearing, and he stated, at that point, he had come to the conclusion with co-counsel that to have McDowell testify in narrative fashion would not be ethical.
But, you know, I mean, there was a lot of back and forth in this proceeding about whether Mr. McDowell really was going to get up there and tell the truth. And counsel clearly struggles with it. He talks to the people in his office, comes to the decision that you just read where he thinks maybe he's, you know, had a heart-to-heart conversation with Mr. McDowell. I don't know. He comes to the decision that it's going to be all right. And then suddenly, of course, he gets this note after McDowell, or, you know, like, looks to me like sort of simultaneously with Mr. McDowell beginning to testify, don't do it. And then his big mistake, you know, surely at that point, if he had said, you know, Your Honor, could we have a 5-minute recess, stops McDowell, they go off, you know, there was a way he could have made that switch.
Absolutely. And you've hit the crux of the case, because he tells the court, and I understand that there was, although he doesn't specifically tell the court who he's concerned about, it's obvious to everybody, and I'm not here to tell you otherwise. He tells the court, I've talked to the client, he's going to testify truthfully, it's going to be a Q&A. Tells everybody that, the client's aware of that. Gives his opening statement, makes promises to the jury, which I'm not going to get into because we all know what they were. One of the promises was he's going to deny having committed the sexual assault. So he's not going to say consensual, he's going to flat out deny it. Puts his client on the witness stand. It's at that point that a conflict occurs. The conflict isn't between himself and multiple clients like in Kyler and some of the other cases. The conflict is between his undivided loyalty to his client and advice he's getting from other lawyers in his office. The note from the lawyer says, Tyroller says, go with a narrative. Tell the client, go with a narrative. He gets the note, stops the trial, talks to the judge. What does he not do? As you just said, he doesn't call a 5-minute recess. He doesn't, as the note told him to do, alleviate the conflict by telling the client. By not telling the client, he goes forward. He asks the client to explain to the jury everything that happened. What does Mr. McDowell do? As we know from the post-conviction hearing, he gets nervous, he clams up. He never denied the sexual assault that took place the day before, which was crucial to this defense. The defense was he didn't do it.
But, you know, I mean, that's all true, but I think the problem is the lawyer is, in fact, standing there. You know, under Kronick, I don't know of any Kronick case where there's been this much lawyer participation, I'll put it that way, and still the presumed prejudice rule was applied. And since we are under AEDPA, why was it not within the realm? I mean, the Wisconsin courts wrote very thoughtful, you know, lengthy opinions in this case. They were trying to work their way through how this is all supposed to work. And they finally say, you know, we just don't see this as a no assistance of counsel during a critical phase kind of case.
Well, if you read Bell versus Cohn, which I know we all know we have, my reading of Bell versus Cohn is you either have to not be there, be asleep, or be dead in order for this to be. I'm just saying that. But in this particular case, he may as well have not been there, been asleep, or been dead for the simple reason that he did not guide his client at a critical stage of the proceeding. And you hit the nail on the head. Had he stopped the trial and told his client, you're going to get one shot now, take your shot. Because after cross-examination, and I know I'm going over, maybe not, after cross-examination, He was never given the opportunity by the judge or by his lawyer to rebut any of the questions on cross, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber.
Good morning. My name is Greg Weber. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin. I represent Warden Kingston in this proceeding. The United States Supreme Court has never held that chronic applies in circumstances where a defense attorney is taking steps to non-cooperate with his client in presenting prospective perjury. Those situations are governed by Strickland versus Washington and Nix versus Whiteside. Those cases were decided, were the clearly established United States Supreme Court precedent at the time the Wisconsin Supreme Court issued its decision in this case.
Mr. Weber, the problem with this record in part is that it seems that there was, as the saying goes, a failure to communicate between Mr. Langford and his office, because Mr. Langford seems to have come to the conclusion that the client was going to testify truthfully. Somebody back in the office who's still thinking about maybe a stale conversation has cold feet, you know, and sends the note in. But one could see this as possibly depriving Mr. McDowell of the assistance of counsel when he was entitled to the Q&A format.
It was a wretched fact situation, and I freely concede that, and which is why the state and the Wisconsin Supreme Court didn't attempt to defend the performance side of Strickland in this case. But Bell versus Cohn, Florida versus Nixon, your own court in Barrow versus Uchtman said that the failure has to be absolute. This is not a situation where trial defense counsel was absent from the courtroom or was prevented from taking steps on his client's behalf. He did, in fact, present his client's testimony in free narrative format. He bracketed in argument the time frame that was involved here. He opened for his client. He closed for his client. He cross-examined witnesses. If anything, this is a situation that's referred to in I believe, Bell v. Cohn as an isolated misstep. And in situations like that, we do not apply chronic. We apply Strickland.
But, you know, it may be in some sense an isolated misstep, but we all know that the Supreme Court has focused on the defendant's right to testify in his own behalf as a very critical right. Of course, it's not something the counsel can waive for him and so on. And I wonder what's the practical difference once he says, go ahead and tell your story, and he closes his mouth. What's the practical difference between what happened and the lawyer, you know, sitting down and pulling out the New York Times and just reading it?
Well, part of it is the analytical framework that this case arises in. It's a Sixth Amendment claim of ineffective assistance, which requires us to look specifically at counsel's performance and the impact of that performance. And it is easy for a reviewing court to evaluate the impact of trial counsel's deficient performance here. We have a full trial. We have a defendant who presented his version of events. We have an adversarial testing.
Well, that's the actual prejudice. I mean, as I understand, actual prejudice has dropped out of this case. The only thing we're talking about here is whether we should presume prejudice from the sequence of events.
Correct, but cases like Chronic and the others talk about a class of cases where a case-by-case evaluation of prejudice either isn't possible or isn't worth the cost. And we are manifestly able, in this case, to analyze counsel's performance and the claim of ineffectiveness in the context of the entire trial. We're able to do what Strickland told courts to do and what Nix versus Whiteside
How would
told
this have been any
to.
Different if he actually believed his client would lie and commit perjury?
If Attorney Langford took his client on the stand and believed that he was going to perjure himself, then I think counsel would have had, among other things, obligations to try and deter him up to the point where he could actually ask to withdraw. That's not an optimum solution because it just passes the perjury on to somebody else. But counsel could have done what he did.
Right.
Say, tell the judge, I can't fulfill my ethical obligations to the court and take my client on question and answer direct examination. I'm going to put him on the stand. I'm going to allow him to testify in free narrative format, and I am going to then make my closing arguments.
We have the same situation we have in this case, right?
Could have had the same situation here. The problem in this case, as Attorney Chiarella pointed out, was that Attorney Langford, at the time he put his client on the stand, everything that had gone forward, notwithstanding, he said, I thought he was going to tell the truth.
Well, and I guess there's a question about whether, particularly actually in light of Attorney Langford's testimony on the post-conviction motion, I guess you have your Mockner proceeding in Wisconsin. As I recall, Attorney Langford said he had gone over the possibility of narrative testimony with Mr. McDowell and had said, this is what you need to do. It's just that he didn't remind him right before the switch was made, okay, now we're on plan B, you know.
And this is why, Judge Wood, this is why in good faith in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, the state, and I've had this case as long as Chris has, we made the argument in the Court of Appeals that it was not deficient performance. We argued that given the broad scope of constitutionally reasonable performance and under the facts of this case, Langford did pretty much everything that a reasonable attorney would have done or could have done to get his client to testify accurately and to litigate the case in that manner. The sticking point, as our Court of Appeals and Supreme Court noted, was at the time that the defendant was put on the stand, his attorney thought he was going to tell the truth. Right. The other attorney gave him the note, and then it went to hell. The United States Supreme Court, similarly to Nixon-Whiteside, the U.S. Supreme Court has never held that an attorney's ethical obligation to the court created a presumptively prejudicial conflict of interest. Kyler and the other cases generally talk about serial representation or simultaneous representation. Nix versus Whiteside makes it clear that in situations where a trial defense attorney is attempting to prevent his client from perjuring himself on the stand, the ethical obligation that the attorney owes to the court doesn't create a conflict of interest that would allow for any presumption of prejudice. If the court has no more questions, I'll stand on my brief.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Yeah, 1 minute.
Thank you. A couple of brief comments. Bell versus Cohn was an isolated misstep that was stated by counsel. It's important to note, and I've quoted Bell versus Cohn, or at least given the facts, Bell versus Cohn dealt with the second exception in Kronik, that being counsel entirely failing to subject the prosecution's case to meaningful adversarial testing. This case doesn't involve itself with that exception. This case involves itself with the denial of counsel at a critical stage of the proceeding. So one can make the argument that language in Cohn doesn't necessarily apply to these particular facts. Secondly, getting to one of the questions you asked, what if counsel believed that his client was going to testify untruthfully in that particular situation? I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, you go with a narrative. That didn't occur here. That scenario didn't occur because, as counsel just explained to you, it was Mr. Langford's position that his client was indeed going to testify truthfully. Thus, a narrative was really out of the question until he received the note, which changed his whole form of thinking.
Mr. Terrell, I hate to... let me just ask you this extra question because this may be important. Has the Supreme Court ever defined critical stage of the proceeding as narrowly as you are suggesting? You know, arraignment might be a critical stage, jury selection might be a critical stage, the trial might... Have they ever actually said the defendant's testimony per se is a critical stage?
If they had, I would have cited the case.
Okay, I didn't think so, but just to check. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Trell, you took this as an appointment, as you have all along, I assume. The court thanks you for your participation and assistance to your counsel, to your client.
Thank you much.
Thank you.